يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello everyone and welcome to Middle East Analysis, and I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian in the seat opposite me. I wish you could see him, he's looking right on top of his game today. Harry, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, James. Serious days we witnessed recently, so I'm looking forward to this podcast.
Well, our listeners and those that have checked out our stuff on Audioboo will know that last time we spoke, we talked about protests in Jordan, which was a big story at the time. And we also talked about the coalition of opposition in Syria. Again, another massive story. But literally, not long after you'd left the building, the huge story, which has resulted in 8 days of violence that most of the world probably can't have failed to notice, is the situation and the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, which fortunately, as we speak, appears to have resulted in something of a respected ceasefire. So, Harry, I'm going to hand that straight over to you and say, bring us up to speed as best you can, and let's actually analyse what this means right now.
Thank you, James. Yes, it was literally as I left the building last time that the conflict between Israel and Hamas and other Palestinian factions in Gaza took place. And I very much realize that unlike other interviews I do, we cannot really talk newsy. We're not going to analyze too much the text of the ceasefire itself. I'm sure that our listeners will be able to get hold of all of that online. It's all over the place. People can easily follow that up. And I respect the fact that it would be interesting to come up with some short-term reactions, because it's only been a few hours since the ceasefire kicked in, 9 p.m. Cairo time last night. So in that sense, I've been thinking as I was coming into your studio, what are some of the thoughts that struck me about this whole conflict and its consequences as I see it today? Now, in the Middle East, everything changes, sometimes quickly, sometimes very slowly. But at the moment, how do things stand? Well, before we do all that, I think you would share with me, and so would all the listeners as well as the conference here, our sadness at the loss of lives on both sides. Any life is sacred, be it Israeli, be it Palestinian, be it of any other nationality or ethnicity. War is an aggressive act, and therefore we think of all those people who died. Roughly, I believe, if the statistics in my head are correct, some 140 Palestinians in Gaza and 5 in Israel. That, for me, is 5 Israelis too many and 140 Palestinians too many dead. Having said that, let's look a little bit, James, at some of the thoughts that cross my mind on this conflict. The first thing I believe that we should mention is that it didn't follow, in my opinion, the expected trajectory. In other words, over the past, when we've had other operations against Gaza, whether when the Israeli tanks have rumbled into that narrow strip, which almost houses 1.7 million residents, it has always been a question of let's go teach them a lesson, destroy the infrastructure of armaments, rockets, etc., and then pull out. Usually that's how it's gone. The Arab world has been more or less mute about it, and there has been a certain sense of apprehension about what we're going to do. Where I think it differs this time is that that barrier of fear was broken. Now, clearly, there is a very, very sharp asymmetry between the power that Israel has militarily and those deployed by the Palestinian factions, be it Hamas or Islamic Jihad or the others. However, what was interesting is for the first time we saw hundreds of rockets lobbed off from Gaza onto targets in Israel itself, in places like Ashkelon, in places like Tel Aviv, even one close enough to Jerusalem, the Holy of Holies. So in that sense, I think that was unexpected. The reaction was unexpected. And I think that took the Israeli military and somewhat political establishment by surprise. And I believe that if you remember, we have kept in touch and I've done many interviews in which a lot of people were saying there's no other way than a land invasion. The tanks are going to rumble into Gaza. And I kept saying, no, I don't think a land invasion will take place. I don't think Hamas and the Palestinian factions want to escalate this fight. Nor, for that matter, do I think Prime Minister Netanyahu and the inner cabinet in Israel want to do so. And as it happens, I was right in this particular instance.
Now, I did want to talk about Egypt and its role in brokering this particular ceasefire deal, and we will do that. But I just wanted to ask you a question about Israel and its near neighbours anyway. I mean, you know, we look at Lebanon and we look back to 2006 and, you know, we saw all the scenes then as well. We now have Gaza, and these things have happened before over history in the last 50 years and more. Part of me thinks, well, do I understand where the Israelis are coming from? You know, there's a proportionality of response question, I think, to be answered here to a certain extent, and that's been asked before. But it must be pretty intimidating for them, number one. But then number two, what is it like for those people that are always the little person being aggressed? It's a very difficult one, isn't it?
It is a very difficult one, James. You're absolutely right. Now, if I put my lawyer's hat on, we can talk about international law and all the concepts of distinction, self-defense, proportionality, and all those issues that are part and parcel of what happened in those 8 days. But let's not get too technical about that. Taking into consideration, you raised the issue of the 2006 war between Hezbollah in South Lebanon and Israel. We also can't forget the 2008-2009 war between Israel and Gaza as well. In a sense, there is the human dimension to it. The human dimension to it is that both sides are fearful. You have the Israelis, about 1 million roughly of Israelis, who are exposed at any time to a rocket flying into their houses, into their territory, and causing damage or even mortality. That in itself, that sense of fear is something that is human and that we should take on board. We cannot just dismiss it by saying, no, it's virtual or unreal. It is very real. And the people who are there, who have to rush into shelters every so often, they have something to fear. They're worried. They're worried for themselves and for their families. Conversely, I think, it is also a fact that Gaza has basically been under siege. We keep talking about Israel having pulled out of Gaza and that Gaza now is no longer Israel's responsibility. Where I think that under the Geneva Fourth Conventions and under international law, let alone in practical terms, it still is, because Gaza has been boxed into a siege situation where nothing can go in and nothing can come out without Israel's say-so. And in that sense, 1.7 million or so Gazan residents who have been like that for years and years, that doesn't play well with the psychology, let alone the physical well-being of all those Gaza residents. If anything, it exacerbates the bitterness, the sense of polarization that they feel about where they are at the moment. Now, this hasn't been helped by the fact that there was a division between the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, in Ramallah, and the Hamas and other factions in Gaza. That split within the Palestinian movement has weakened the Palestinians far more than anything else. If anything, this struggle, this war, this 8-day conflict, I believe, will hopefully bring the factions, the Palestinian factions, together so that they can start talking in one voice again. Because at the end of the day, if they themselves don't know what's in their interest, then it is not for the world to worry more about their interest than it is for themselves to worry about it and what happens to their political future. But also the difference that has been quite clear, and every commentator and analyst I've heard on radio or television has made this valid point, is that the MENA region today is no longer the MENA region of 2 years ago. The dynamics have changed. changed. Egypt, which was the arbitrator, the mediator, the principal mover behind this very short agreement. This text is only a few lines long with three or four points between the two parties, that we now have an entirely different political thinking in Egypt than the one we had under the former president Hosni Mubarak, who was overthrown. We have a region that has changed in Tunisia, in Libya. Syria is very much in the throes of change. So in a sense, the reaction of the Arab world has also been different this time than it has been in the past. This is why I think that when we take those changes, add them to the fact that, in my opinion, both sides would like to see some peace and quiet on their border so that they can then get on with their lives. This is what makes me hope that this truce is workable. Interestingly enough, the truce or the ceasefire, call it what it may, although in my legal mind there is a difference between a ceasefire and a truce, but in Arabic it's called hudna. Hudna is not just an Arabic word I'm throwing at you. Hudna is also an Islamic concept, which at its simplest would indicate that this is a kind of a ceasefire, a long-term ceasefire, without actually recognition by Hamas and the Palestinian factions of Israel. So that is a political sensitive point, which means that there is every hope that this agreement that they struck yesterday will not be just a 1 or 2 day agreement. I tweeted about it and I said that I spoke with a Gazan colleague of mine and I said to him, I said, what do you think? Will this one hold? And he said something very English. He said, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And in a sense, it's very true. But I believe that at the moment, it's in the interest of both the Gaza-Palestinian factions as well as Israel to make this happen.
Now, for all our listeners out there, if you do want to follow Harry on Twitter, then you just have to go for @HarryHagopian. I recommend you do that. Lots of insights on there, some retweets, plenty of original thinking. Get on that if you've got yourself on Twitter. Can we focus then on resolution and hopefully reconciliation of some sort? You mentioned Egypt. Egypt has the principal player. And in those few lines that we have here of the agreement, yeah, Egypt shall receive assurances from appears more than once. And so they're right at the centre of this, aren't they?
They're very much at the centre. There are some winners, in my opinion, and some losers at the end of those 8 violent days, James. In my opinion, President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt and the Egyptian establishment played a very constructive and a very positive role, actually. It was a test for them. How are they going to play this? Are they going to say, blood is thicker than water, we are the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, so therefore we completely side with them, and therefore Israel will never have accepted this agreement? No, they played it carefully. They were quite clear about what they thought of the attack against Palestinian factions in Gaza. In fact, the whole Arab world was quite clear about it this time, and the whole Muslim world, much more vocal and outspoken than previously. But at the same time, they helped put this together. And what makes me also confident that there might be a chance that this hudna, this ceasefire, this truce would hold for at least a while, is the fact that Egypt is now the guarantor from the Palestinian side that its provisions will be implemented. In other words, no rockets. In other words, no violence coming from the Gaza side. But if you saw on television yesterday, when the foreign minister of Egypt, Amer, declared the ceasefire had happened, the agreement, who was standing next to him? Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, U.S. And she was the one who actually was, in a sense, the counterpart with Israelis by reassuring Israel of America's unstinting support for it. And therefore, between the Egyptians and the Americans, I think those two were in some way the biggest winners at the moment, if you were playing a game of winner-lose, of the outcome of those 8 days in terms of this ceasefire agreement.
Well, you know, it's always hard with audio to paint those pictures, and we should certainly seek to do that. But I liked it when we were talking Syria the other day, when we were talking about impact on near neighbours, and you said of Lebanon, when Syria sneezes, Lebanon catches a cold, which I think is a lovely descriptive thing. But I'm now wondering, is Egypt setting itself up as the Middle East pharmacist?
Egypt is not really setting up itself as the Middle East pharmacist, but what Egypt is doing, and that falls, I think, into the winner-loser game, what Egypt is doing after years and years of basically losing its place in the Arab world, Egypt is reassuming its position as a leader of the Arab world. And in a sense, the one country that has the clout in order to make things happen. Now, this was something that the Arab world always acknowledged, but then gradually it petered out because Egypt became less and less crucial, less and less critical, partly because of the political realities in the country itself. Post the 25 January revolution, things have changed, and Egypt is trying to reassume that position. And it's very interesting that it's reassuming it at a time when the Muslim Brotherhood is at the helm, president, majority in a parliament that is dysfunctional but still there. In a sense, I believe that it is not in Egypt's interest to antagonize the Americans. They need them financially, if for nothing else. It is not in the interest of Egypt either to tinker with the peace agreement between itself and Israel, because it doesn't want a new front now with Israel. Egypt's clearest and most urgent needs are internal, and it's one word: economy. If Morsi can pull it off, then he can win the people over. If he doesn't pull it off, then he's going to lose gradually the support of the people. However, politically, it is playing a role, an increasing role. And interestingly enough, when we talk about winners and losers, did you also notice, or did our listeners notice, how things have changed in the Arab world, James? Syria and its president, not a pipsqueak, not a word came out of Syria about the situation in Gaza. If anything, now they have turned against Hamas and against the Palestinian factions. So that, to me, is a radical change, when in the past, Syria would have been the first country, in terms of its president and regime, to sort of support, at least vocally, not much else actually, the Palestinian movements for independence and self-determination. Nothing. That, to me, says volumes about what is happening within Syria, what is happening in the dynamics between Syria and the Palestinians, and what is happening in the Arab world. The other thing I will throw at you and share with our listeners, the United Nations. What happened with the United Nations? Again, we show that the United Nations is a lumbering institution that cannot actually get its act together, because it wasn't the UN that put this agreement together. It was basically two countries, largely, Egypt and the United States. So in that sense, bilateral negotiations preempt UN impact at the moment. Then Iran. Iran is a very interesting factor, because although lip service was paid to Iran by the Hamas militants, I still think there is a reconfiguration of the Arab world where the Palestinians are going more toward the Turkey, Egypt, even, dare I say, Qatari axis, and away from the Syria-Iran axis. And in that sense, I believe that what is happening to me clearly is that everybody, including in this building, I've had conversations where we've talked about the centrality of Palestine in the whole Middle East political thinking. And is it being replaced by the Iran nuclear issue and Iranian hegemony over the region? What these 8 days have done, and what the negotiations that led up to this agreement have also done, is recentered Palestine again as the hub of the region and the most important political conflict for the whole region. That, to me, is very important. And if the Palestinians, whether by going to the United Nations General Assembly, if they do, or whether by healing their wounds and closing ranks, if they manage to take this opportunity to revive the Palestinian issue in the political imagination of the world and not leave it to a defunct quartet or the world to just think about romantically, then it would be interesting to see where they can push this whole situation. Because at the end of the day, and as Alain Grèche from the Le Monde Diplomatique was saying yesterday when he was interviewed, and he's somebody I actually have a lot of time for, he was saying that at the end of the day, the issue is not a ceasefire. The issue is not an agreement. The issue is the end of an occupation of Palestinian territory by Israel so that justice can apply for both peoples. The issue is not let's keep Gaza quiet or let's keep the Palestinians quiet or let's make sure that Israelis are not attacked by rockets. It is to go to the heart of the conflict, which is the unlawful and unacceptable occupation of one people by another. The second message I would leave with you, James, and it's an important message, is that whilst all the media was interested in Gaza, Israel, and what's happening there, there was a veritable social media war going out there. You know, some people were talking that it's the first time in the Middle East that the war was led by Twitter rather than only by tanks rumbling into the country. But all this was happening whilst Syria was also raging on. And in that sense, you have some leftists, some intellectuals, you have some liberal thinkers from the establishment who suddenly sprang up and sort of say, we cannot accept this to happen to the Palestinians and we have to protest. Fair enough. I agree with a lot of the points they raise in their discourse. However, is there not an irony of double standards that they get so het up with that? But when we have 40,000 dead in Syria as a result of an equal amount of thuggery, very much less reaction is happening by the outside world. So in a sense, I think those double standards tell us a few things about the realities of politics, but they also leave a bitter taste in many, many Syrian mouths that I speak with.
Now, I'm going to have to conclude this. Probably return back to what you said at the very start, which is obviously that the prayers for and our sympathies with those who have lost their lives or their family members who have on both sides, both on the Israel side and Gazan side. So we remember that as we conclude this podcast. And yes, let's hope that the Hudna, the agreement, actually holds this time, Harry, so we don't have this conversation in another couple of years.
Well, I hope we won't have this conversation, but another kind of conversation where we are talking in a more peaceful and ironic manner. And I agree with you entirely. Our thoughts and prayers are with the peoples of the region, all those who are affected by violence. And may I always mention and remind our listeners, James, as an afterthought on this, that there is a very small Palestinian Arab Christian community in Gaza. We tend to forget that. We tend to look at this in very monochromatic terms. Muslims on the one side, Jews on the other. There is a very small but quite active, albeit diminishing, Christian community, largely Orthodox or Catholic, in Gaza. Let me also say that when we were talking about Al-Shifa Hospital as being where most of the victims were being taken in Gaza as a result of the aerial bombardments, that we also have an Anglican-sponsored hospital in Gaza called Al-Ahli, that we have the Middle East Council of Churches, which has a humanitarian presence in Gaza. So it is, of course, political first and foremost, but I just want to remind our listeners, coming from a conference perspective, that those prayers are also for their sisters and brothers who are living there and going through difficult times as well.
Well, you're absolutely right to remind us of that, and that's a solid conclusion. A couple of reminders for our listeners. As I say before, if you want to catch up with Dr. Harry Hagopian, our Middle East North Africa analyst, on Twitter, you can do so at Harry Hagopian. If you want to keep in touch with the church, keep in touch with us at Catholic EW. These podcasts, as always, are going out on catholicnews.org.uk, and you can just simply search for Middle East Analysis or append Middle-East-Analysis. Now, we'll be back with a regional roundup very soon, but for now, Dr. Harry Hagopian, thanks as always.
Pleasure, James.